Hey, how are you guys doing? My name is Kevan Devani, the host of the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. Bitcoin, you know, is the monetary revolution. And, you know, fiat money in whatever shape or form has always failed. It's always been a miserable, catastrophic, pain-causing experiment that's been going on for such a long time. So without further ado, I want to announce my next special talk with Emil Sundstedt, Econo Alchemist, and Mick. I'm going to put their sites, their websites on the show notes. Please give it a like, retweet, share, subscribe, please, to my YouTube channel, my podcast platforms. It's going to be an awesome talk. We're going to go really down the rabbit hole, especially about the history of money, fiat money, you know, the current situation evolving with central bank digital currencies, the surveillance panopticon, fascist tyrannical, you know, governmental shit that's going on. So a lot of topics to talk about. Thanks so much again for your support, for listening. And don't forget to subscribe. Without further ado, here's my talk with Emil, Mick, and Econo Alchemist. All right, welcome to the show. My name is Kevan Devani. My very special guest is Emil Sundstedt, who I've already had on my show a few times actually. Then we have Econo Alchemist and Mick. So how are you guys doing? Thanks so much for your time coming to my show. How's everything?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for this opportunity.
All right. Yeah, my pleasure. Listen, guys, I mean, I've been trying to I brainstorm a little bit, like, what could be the, like, common denominator, what we could talk about, like, especially when I look at all your, you know, amazing content you throw out on Twitter or on your blogs, what have you, like, Emil with your website, bdratings.org, and then we have Burn the Bridge, that's, or Economy Alchemist with his Twitter handle, with his, you know, amazing articles on, I just read the latest one, to be honest with you, especially the one with intrusive surveillance is, what's the title? I think intrusive surveillance, something like that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Intrusive surveillance is someone's full-time job.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we have MetaMick 14, or Mick, I'm going to call him Mick, with his, yeah, you got a very interesting site. It's called Money Mail. Maybe we want to talk about that. So Mick and Econo Alchemist, would you like the two of you, because Emil already, you know, been on my show, so most of my listeners know him. Could you like introduce yourself a little bit, and, you know, what is Bitcoin to you? Why are you in Bitcoin?
Sure, yeah. So I got started with Bitcoin in late 2018. It was Christmas Day, and my brother-in-law was into cryptocurrencies. And so I started asking him about Bitcoin, and that started me down the path of learning about Bitcoin. And the more I learned about it, the more I started realizing how important self-custody and privacy and being able to use Bitcoin in a way that is censorship resistant. And initially I was interested in Bitcoin because of the upside potential to make money. But the more I learned about it, the more that became less important, and the other properties of Bitcoin became more important to me. And so now, you know, fast forward a couple years, I'm trying to learn as much as I can still, and trying to take what I learn and put it out there in the form of my blog or Twitter content. I do a lot of threads on Twitter about how to use Bitcoin in a way that you are taking self-custody of it, and using Whirlpool and interacting with it privately. So now I just try and share ideas that get people thinking about the importance of self-custody and censorship resistance.
Fascinating. Yeah, I love your stuff, man. So, Mick, I read something on your Twitter handle that you are also a UX designer. Is that true?
Yeah. So I'm actually a user researcher, but I have a mixed background in economics and anthropology. So I did a BA in both. My interest and my sort of passion has always been really in understanding behavior and kind of trying to get to people's behaviors and way of thinking, belief systems, and so forth. And my take has always been to do so from, I guess, different ways of doing that. And I'd go to an economics class and they would teach you that humans are rational. And then I go to, and they would tell you progress is good. And then you'd go to anthropology course and they will tell you humans are not so rational. Although economics has definitely changed since then, but exposed to very, very different methods and ways of thinking, different epistemologies. I've been applying these ways of thinking and these academic approaches in the realm of technology. So I'm working a lot as a user researcher, as a consultant for startups, but also more sort of fintech labs and so forth. And I'm happy to talk about Moneymill if the chance comes up. But in terms of the answer for your question, when did I sort of get interested in Bitcoin? I think it was in 2010 that I was first exposed to Bitcoin. I was told by all these friends that this was sort of, you know, this virtual currency that you could just buy, and people, you know, some friends of mine would use it to buy drugs, not for anything else at the moment. But I remember really clearly them saying, "Hey, how about we buy some? And who knows what's going to happen?" And me saying, "What is this BS? This virtual money?" And I think at the point I had this idea that Bitcoin was just virtual, like as in virtuals and, you know, could be made up, right? And then I got exposed to it again, sort of from time to time, but I really didn't quite understand the implications of it until 2017, when I realized that it was 2000. And I started paying attention to it and reading more about it and understanding the fundamental technological mechanisms which work, the fact that it's incontrollable, that nobody, no single central authority can control it. The decentralization element for sure spoke to me, because what happens when in a world in which money, a decentralized form of money, cannot be destroyed, right? And we've seen this again, we see people still keep on trying to think, okay, governments will ban it, or, you know, people who don't have a grasp of it will say to you, it will be turned off. This is the problem. The genie is out of the bottle. It's like, now it's the question, how is the world going to react to Bitcoin now that it's alive, now that it's well, now that it's strong? So to me, it's sort of thinking about the economics in a macro perspective. It's like, how does the world with a world that exists with Bitcoin responds to its own existence. And so it's sort of led me down the rabbit hole. There's so much amazing content out there that you cannot but be led down the areas of economics, down finance, and then looking at the current economic system, you know, that is what it is. So it's been ever since going deeper and deeper.
Fascinating. Thanks for sharing. So Emil, we've been having so many discussions also either one-on-one with you or with Stephanie von Jahn, you know, the economist from Germany. Mm-hmm. And I took, you know, I bring somebody like a working title for an episode, and I wrote, you know, like on for the thumbnail, I'm like, okay, let's talk about like fiat money, you know, like why is this like been a continuous failed, fucked up experiment, for more than hundreds and hundreds of years, and why we're not learning from history, and is Bitcoin, you know, finally, at last, you know, the monetary evolution we've been waiting for? The cat is out of the bag, as you know, Mick also said, and the genie's out of the bottle. So, what are we waiting for?
Yeah, the Bitcoin part is still speculative, and we are all hoping and working for the best. But as to your first question, is that can't we learn from history? this is actually a question that I see when I study monetary history as well. And people ask this question hundreds, 100 years ago and 200 years ago. They ask, do we not learn from history? So that kind of proves that we don't really learn from history. Because when countries embark on these monetary experiments, they always try to rationalize the past failure occurred. I have two examples of this in France. This actually my two favorite examples are the French experiment by John Law in beginning of 18th century, and the assignat experiment 80 years later, so also in the 18th century. And it's kind of curious because during the second experiment, when they knew that the first experiment had completely failed, they rationalized it by, in this case, the first experiment was conducted when France was an absolute monarchy. That means you have a really powerful guy in power. So 8 years later, when they saw the first monetary experiment fail, they rationalized it by saying that, yeah, but it was this powerful central authority that printed too much money. Now we are a constitutional republic. So now it's in the interest of the people as a collective to not wreck the money, right? So every time these fiat money experiments, they come wrapped in new kind of apologies for the past failures. And we have seen it time and time again. So no, I don't think we will really learn from history. I think we will continue to repeat. But the more these things are repeated, the more people actually can learn from them, I guess. And I can actually pivot to, because I'm writing a book right now about these early paper money experiments.
Is that your second book?
It's my second book, yeah. So it's a second money dethroned. So I wrote, I have the first book here. It's called Money Dethroned, A Historical Journey. It deals with primitive monies.
Great book.
And metallic monies. So it's kind of this early evolution of money. The second book deals with the early paper money experiments. And the thing I want to point out by showing these different failures of past paper money experiments, fiat money, it's not to wallow in you know, failure and laugh at countries that fail. It's because we can infer from these experiences, we can draw conclusions based on them and apply it today when we analyze Bitcoin and when we analyze the current system.
So do you think we are at like, well, what do you guys think? Are we at like a super critical juncture of you know, monetary history, where all these, you know, the concentrated sick diseases come to the surface, you know, the symptoms with negative rates and everything else, you know, with whatever has to do with, you know, connected to state, to government, to surveillance, to, I mean, everything around us. Is that like a culmination? Is that, what do you guys think?
I think to answer that, and I think maybe it's a way to also to pick it up with what Emil was saying, with the question of inevitability, is money perhaps something that is tied to the overall structure of a civilization? And Emil, I was reading through some chapters of your book on the Roman Empire. And one cannot wonder whether, you know, it is. I mean, on one hand, money is a, the civilization depends on money, right, for its own functioning, and you know, and by that I mean money that is hard money that is backed by real substantive thing, not money that is diluted that leads lack of price discovery and so forth. But could it be that you actually that it's actually the other way around, right? So it's not a civilization needs money, but also that it's the turmoil and the challenges that the civilization is undergoing leads the civilization to dilute it because of its constraints and limitations.
Yeah, definitely. Money is, as you indicated, money is the glue that keeps division of labor together. It's completely necessary for civilization to function. Money is fundamental for people to be able to specialize. We specialize, we produce what we are good at, and then we trade through money. So this is why, so money is in the middle of the whole of this. So this is why it's so important that when this central banks and governments start to mess with the money and they start to hammer away on the money, that is hammering away on the thing we use to stave off starvation. Division of labor is extremely important. And if division of labor falls, the producer of food cannot trade with the consumer of food. So it's an extremely serious issue. And it seems that if we infer from history, many civilizations have embarked on actually seizing on the money. It's usually when they already are in trouble, like they have already taxed the population, what they can do. All the, you know, proper taxes are in place. They have already taken up enough debt so that people don't want to lend more money to them for good interest rate. So it's one of the last things that they can do to seize on the money, to produce money for low cost and to spend it for its full value. So, yeah, it's in a way inevitable if they can seize money. And with Bitcoin, of course, it's much, much harder to seize on Bitcoin. It's extremely hard, I would say. So it's definitely a large improvement.
To me, what this means, though, is that who has to learn here is not so much the civilization, the leaders of civilization, like the central banks. It's more the people have to realize that they have this tool that can enable all their time, effort, and work to not be diluted away. To me, this is possibly one interesting conclusion, is that it is us, it is the people, and that central banks, to some extent, they're doing what they can with the tools they have. And I think, I really do believe that a lot of these people do have good intentions behind their action. They really do think that printing will help. And it actually will help in the short run, right? But this is more of a medium to long. I mean, to now we're probably more in the shorter run, but the dilution of money is more of a, okay, we will, it's kind of kicking the can down the road a bit, isn't it?
Yeah. Mick, can I ask you a question? Because you have studied the German experiment, right? The inflation. I haven't studied that period. So when I saw that you tweeted about this event, and I wondered when the hyperinflation there kicked in, do you have any feeling for what the German central bank were thinking?
Like, that's such a good question.
Did they know that they were wrecking the money, or was it just general confusion?
That's a great question, and the book keeps on saying this, which, I mean, I would like to challenge to some extent, and I would love to go more in depth, really understand if there was more sinister beliefs, but they really didn't associate money printing to the dilution of money. They saw money printing as the consequence of inflation, not the cause, which is bizarre.
Yeah, this is very interesting. It's very interesting because when I read these experiences from France, for example, there is one effect that I want to talk to you about, and it's quotations from the past that people feel like there's a sudden shortage of money. Meanwhile, the central bank is mass producing money, so it's a kind of paradox, right?
Yes, exactly.
So the more the central bank is printing, the more references we can see that people are complaining that there's a shortage of money. Hmm. And this is, when I noticed this, I mean, it's very important to understand the dynamics, I think.
It's because really similar. Yeah, you're spot on.
To me, it's kind of a point for hyperinflation, that when the money that you add to the system is worth, if you add 10% of the money supply, for example, but the total value of all the money in society decreases by around 20%, because prices are always forward-looking in a free market. So the value of money is always forward-looking. So that means that the new production chases fewer and fewer goods and services. So people's savings can't keep up with prices. And the more money is printing, the more people will feel like there's a scarcity of money. So this is extremely dangerous, I think, when this feeling sets in among the population.
Absolutely. Yeah, you see the same mentions of shortage of money. And it's quite perplexing, right? Because it assumes that money, that it's a question of what, you know, in this discussion, where is the economy? Where is productivity? This is totally out of the question, because in this system, you have exorbitant unemployment at one of the heights the entire German experiment Germany was taken over by France. The entire Ruhr region, the most productive region in Germany, 80% of the coal mines, 70% of the iron ore, the most industrious region in Germany was taken over by France for a period of years. The entire population was put on subsidies and support system. This is millions of people. I believe around 2 million people just in the Ruhr region out of 6 million in total, something like that. That led to, so there was a lot of unemployment, a lot of people demanding, like we are now to some extent on furlough, demanding money. The money you're giving me is not enough, right? And that discussion of the money not being enough happens when it's the government providing the subsidies, and because the economy is somewhat in dire straits.
Yeah, and just to add quickly, I think that this dynamic that we talked about is that there's a flat shortage of money when there really isn't. There's an abundance of money. I think these are the reports that we banks from all different sources that there is a shortage of money. So they get these conflicting reports. They see that they are mass printing. And meanwhile, they get reports and they get pressured by politicians that there's a shortage of money. So it's kind of understandable that some nations end up in these heaps of paper money in the streets. It's not 100% nefarious policy. It's an effect of confusion and just stupidity.
And also somewhat, it's a policy that is very active to people's demands. People really feeling that way, let's print more money and solve the problem. I got that sense also from the German case, that it was almost a socialist leaning policies led to a lot of this. Let's support the people so that they don't revolt, so that they don't burn our houses and don't burn the streets. But that has consequences. So I think looking into the mechanics helps you appreciate that what's happening is not necessarily an evil system or a nefarious one, but it's just a lot of misunderstanding about the nature of the economy. It's a lot of short-termism of kind of helping people today without understanding the consequences that money printing has later on.
Let's maybe extrapolate this to the current situation right now with the this whole topic about central bank digital currencies, Lagarde propagating or pushing this digital euro, because the monetary system is based on debt, right? I mean, I think we agree on that. Is the plan to somehow eliminate the commercial banks, the banks out of the equation, and put like the central bank digital currencies? And then what happens? I mean, is that going to be like a deflationary shock? And then we would go into inflation, hyperinflation, or where would you see this going or evolve?
Well, personally, I have no clue, actually. It's so complicated these days. I have studied from the 19th century and backwards. But these days, I mean, I do have a grasp of how it works, but it's very hard to say where we are going. But I can say this, that there are some signs that there can be more trouble soon, because you get all of these new doctrines like modern monetary theory, MMT, And this, it's kind of new speak going around that we need a new economy that works for everyone. We need a, you know, a little bit like a people's economy. These are also recurring, you know, signs that when they mean that economic laws differ between continents, or that economic laws differ between time periods. I mean, the economy doesn't work like this. There's nothing new today. So when they think that there is something special today, and they want to implement their crazy policies because of this thought, that's dangerous. So we will see what happens with this MMT people, if they're shunned or if they're, you know, embraced soon or not.
Yeah, I think it's kind of hard to understand what's going to happen. We do live though in totally uncharted territory. So it's what's now happening. I think if we want to understand what is happening today, where we have to look is China, that's now experimenting with their CBDC, right? And you see them sending out airplane money to millions of people all over the country. I think the reception has been so far that it hasn't worked really well. But the only reason is because they already have Alipay and other amazing systems of payments that are entirely digital. This is somewhat of a still early on prototype. But what's happening is the central banks totally bypassing the banks, right? Yeah. These are wallets that the government, the central bank, is sending directly to the hands of the citizen, right? So the inflationary potential of this cannot be understated, right? So in Germany, what you had was somewhat of an indirect line, right? You did have money going to, you know, to people, for people could receive it, but the majority of the money was going to corporates. It was going to corporate industrial companies that would then employ people. Now it's, this is still what's happening today, right? Out of the $1.7 trillion printed, in QE in the States, I believe only, was it 300 million went in, it was even less, I don't quote me, but it was like 10% or so that went into support, unemployment benefits and so forth. So the majority is still going to corporates, but in a system such as this one, there's so much more like direct to consumer, which I think could lead to a system in which people, millions are unemployed, but still receiving support.
And to add to this, the usual way money is issued these days, I think Kayvon, you and me and Stephanie talked about this, that the common way these days, it's issued through debt. That means that when the money goes out to society, at the same time, a debt instrument is created that's put on the balance sheet of the central bank. And that means that the system is constructed so that the debt is, they have a repayment plan. So the debt is coming back, or the money is coming back to the central bank. And when it comes back to the central bank, it's actually burned. This is a very old tradition. They did it in the 18th century, 19th century also, that sometimes they collected notes to burn it, because otherwise you would just have this inflationary effect. But when they now, these days, send out money to consumers directly, I don't think there is a debt instrument that's backing it. I mean, there's no way for the money to go to the central bank to be burned. So this is very dangerous, because when it's stuck in the economy, it has no way to get burned. That's inflation. It's gonna, prices are gonna rise.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was my question then, you know, so what would happen? It's a very scary thought, especially when you know that you have a central bank digital currency that is, as in China with the whatever social credit system, and they're pushing it like hardcore. Like, what would that mean for the individual? You know, I mean, we'll talk, you know, economy, alchemist, you are like deep into, you know, you've written about censorship resistance and decentralization and disintermediation. And, it's about individual sovereignty. So the central bank would then know everything about the individual, like what have you bought, even in 100 years, where have you bought it? They can just, you know, cut you off from the money stream if you're not in favor of a, you know, some political, you know, if you're not supporting some kind of political opinion that is sort of how the official narrative. What's your position on that? I mean, is Bitcoin the eventually thought of or you know designed to be the black market money for, you know, for all of us eventually? When is going to be, you know, like a tipping point where people are going to reject, you know, not only unethical, unconstitutional, but actually totally illegitimate laws and regulations?
Yeah, that's a good question. It reminds me of the frog sitting in the pot of water as it starts to boil. And slowly but surely, these laws and regulations encroach on our individual liberties and rights. And a couple generations go by and you have an entire population that's enslaved. It's difficult not to speculate that the central bank digital currencies are simply going to be a tool to control their populations. As you mentioned, they would be able to shut off someone's livelihood at the flip of a switch. And I think that this is, it's really dangerous. And I do think we are at a very critical juncture where if we allow the collection of our personal information and allow this to get tied to a digital currency that is being issued directly from a central bank, that means that they can shut it off and take it back from us just as easily. And there's a guy on Twitter called NixOps, N-I-X-O-P-S. He has a great saying. He produces some really good content. His saying is, don't let Bitcoin become the greatest revolution that never happened. And I do think that this is a very critical juncture, and it's part of the reason why I'm advocating for self-sovereignty and self-custody and keeping your KYC information out of Bitcoin. Because if you can operate with your money privately and control your own keys and interact with a network that is censorship resistant, then there's no central authority that's going to be able to stop you. But this freedom, this potential freedom that people have right now is constantly being threatened. And there's efforts to create these KYC mining pools and to control the Bitcoin right from the beginning. And, you know, I do foresee this turning into a split where there is a black market Bitcoin and a clean Bitcoin market. I don't think the black Bitcoin market is ever going to go away. I think miners will continue to process transactions that are, even if the address is on the OFAC list. But, you know, those are some of the proposals that they're trying to put into place, is to create mining pools that will not process transactions, not because they don't meet consensus rules, but because they don't agree with the person who, or the entity who controls the private keys. So, yeah, I think the best thing people can do is to control their own keys, to self-custody their Bitcoin, and to keep their personal information out of it.
Yeah. And Giacomo Zucco, as you probably all know, just recently tweeted something with a reference to an article of Eric Vasquiel. You probably know it from Libitcoin, and, you know, where Eric Vasquiel sort of describes in a pretty short article, like the phases, like the honeymoon phase, the competition phase, and where eventually, I don't know all those four phases by name, but it's sort of where I understand it is that the governmental mining pool would censor transactions at a loss. And so you will have, as you said, you know, the black market harvesting, you know, those fees, and then you have those, yeah, those sort of official, like, you know, artificially cleansed transactions, which then are not going to go through if it's somehow flagged or whatever or tainted, right?
Yeah. In my opinion, central banks have been fucking up the money for a very long time, and it's in everyone's best interest to take them out of the equation. I think central banks should all be abolished. I don't think they should have anything to do with our money.
Yeah, and, you said it. No, because seriously, I mean, they're above the law. I mean, nobody's talking about this like big elephant in the room. It's like a criminal entity above the law that can do anything with total criminal immunity. And nobody's asking questions, you know. I mean, I didn't give my vote to them, you know, whether it's the fucking European Central Bank with the, you know, criminally convicted Lagarde. You know, I mean, it's mind-boggling if you think about it, right?
Yeah, the fact that I can exchange my time and my livelihood for money to do the things in my life, and then they can debase that money, essentially stealing my time away from me, is just absolutely maddening. It's a disgusting process. And, you know, I really do think it's a form of enslavement.
Yeah. Totally.
And,
yeah.
I think Bitcoin is a way for people to escape that stronghold and to interact with each other and their economies in a way that can't be stopped.
Yeah.
What's beautiful about the situation, though, is that it kind of doesn't matter what the central banks exist or not. It really doesn't matter because you can totally opt out. Does that make sense? Like, governments can do whatever they want. You can print as much money as you want. In fact, it's going to be better for me as a Bitcoin holder. This is the thing, the beauty, the elegance of this entire approach, right? Is that it's a nonviolent protest in which you can continue. I don't necessarily care if central banks get abolished or not. I don't want to impose my violence on somebody else, but I have my own little kitty corner and I'm going to live here and you can do whatever you want to it, but I'm going to live in my own, approach and not have my money debased.
So you guys think, we've been like talking like a few times now about this critical juncture. Is it good that now, you know, on different levels, institutions, whatever, all these Michael Saylors and Paul Tudor Jones and the Druckenmiller, whatever the name are, like, is it good that it's taking place? Is it taking place simultaneously? The adoption, the, you know, the funneling of capital, the awareness of people now, you know, like FOMOing in it. Is that good? Is that good?
Quick thought on that. I think we're seeing that, but I think we're seeing that in the higher echelons of the financial markets. I think we've seen so many billionaires coming in. We've seen a lot of, you know, Bitcoin some of the key financial kind of channels. You don't really see it yet in the mainstream newspapers so much. I think you're starting to see that for sure, but more in the financial arena of our world.
I mean, one good thing that more people just get into Bitcoin is they do become more interested in money. They read more about money, and they, for the first time maybe in their lives, they start to think about what money is. Because before Bitcoin, there was only one, or there was no choice. You had the national money, unless you wanted to obtain something on the black market, essentially. So when there's only one choice, it doesn't make that much sense to spend too many hours thinking about it.
I think the one thing about these institutions that are moving into the market that is disgusting is companies offering services like PayPal, where they're taking the ideas of Bitcoin, the market hype of Bitcoin, the logos, the branding, they're selling the ideas of Bitcoin to people. It's decentralized, it's peer-to-peer, it's digital, but that's not what they're delivering. So PayPal is selling people the idea of Bitcoin, but they're not actually letting people use Bitcoin. And in fact, in their terms of service, they're encouraging people not to interact with Bitcoin, in a way that they're taking self-custody because it's too risky and it's too dangerous. And I think that is frightening about the institutions moving into Bitcoin, because I think the mass population at this critical juncture can get confused and believe that they are participating in the Bitcoin network when really they're just getting an IOU from PayPal. Yeah. And in that sense, I can see the Bitcoin, the greatest revolution that's never going to happen, completely getting sacked by the institutions and the regulators. And I think that would be more harmful.
This is a very good point, actually, because people go for these centralized custodians because it's convenient right now. The infrastructure, the scaling infrastructure like Lightning Network, etc., it has it's progressing, but it's difficult for some. It's less difficult for others. So as we're waiting for that to progress further, people are kind of sent into these centralized institutions instead. And then we end up with a situation akin to how gold was previously. That, of course, many people had the physical gold at home, or they owned it themselves. But a large majority had IOUs. They had notes that were supposedly redeemable to gold. So it's important that people can take self-custody and that the infrastructure continues to progress. We will see how that works and how quick all these new people are going to come into Bitcoin, because as it is right now, the Bitcoin network is not fully ready for, world adoption. It's still experimental. That's why you have this reckless meme on that Lightning network.
I mean, when it comes to Lightning, definitely, it's still, as I see it, sort of in a developmental, pretty risky phase. But I don't know, Mick, what would you say? I mean, are we evolving now much faster? I mean, compared, of course, to a couple of years or years ago, online, just normal Bitcoin transaction. I mean, we've got like so many wallets now, mobile wallets, hardware wallets, even full node. To a certain degree, you need still to have some kind of interest and, patience to, connect it, and you need to take your time and educate yourself. Do you see this as a something evolutionary right now, or do you think it's going to take many, many years to come?
Yeah, good question. I think, I haven't taken notes over the 13 years of Bitcoin's history, but I think the last 4 years have seen pretty massive technical improvements from all the new wallets coming in. And in terms of Bitcoin's infrastructure and the network per se, I don't think it's changed much necessarily. I think that's probably a good thing. I have spoken with some, and I'm not an engineer myself, so I'm not the best person to answer that perhaps, but a lot of the engineers I've spoken to who work in Bitcoin have said that, the system is incredibly sound, and as the hash rate continues to grow, so is safety and security of the network. I think, although I do agree with Emil that Bitcoin is still an experiment in many ways, we still haven't tested all the dark challenges that we might face, especially if the government really wanted to try to take it down, which I don't think it's possible because of the decentralized nature. But an energy based approach, possibly. I don't know, right? But it is still experimental in the sense that we haven't faced all the challenges yet. That said, I think it has proven itself to be a big player. And as soon as Bitcoin reaches the hundreds of thousands of dollars, it will start receiving a bit of a... I think this is where moving on to the question of what are Bitcoin's challenges and threats. I think it goes back to our conversation about governments possibly banning it. And I don't buy that. I don't buy that because it's just... But I think there will be a very... multi-centered or varied approach by different governments to Bitcoin. Like we saw yesterday, the ECB said something about banning Bitcoin, actually. Yeah, so I think it's still something that, we have to see, and there will be different approaches. I believe Bitcoin will withstand most of them, but I mean, also, I don't know, right? I don't know.
Can I add a couple of things here? I think that Bitcoin is extremely solid when it comes to the base layer. Mm-hmm. I mean, the what do we call it, the first layer. That has been battle tested for 12 years. And it's just, that's not where the problem lies, in my opinion. The problem will be when millions and millions or hundreds of millions are going to onboard these scaling solutions that are not centralized. That will be really a trial, because it will be adversarial, and it's all open source software. It's in a sense smart contracts on Bitcoin, this Lightning infrastructure. So they will be attacked, and people will try to exploit them. And we have seen what happened in some extreme cases in other chains, and not to compare Bitcoin with all its altcoins. But let's take the second largest Ethereum. If you remember the bug, this critical bug they had in one of their software implementations, and hundreds of thousands of their tokens were suddenly stuck because they missed a little thing. I mean, that can happen if there's a lot of Bitcoins circulating in Lightning, and then there's a bug somewhere in the most popular implementation. We can end up with a really scary situation there as well. So, again, I think the base layer is very, very sound. I don't see any large chance that will screw things up. I think the challenge is in the scaling.
Yeah. That's a great point. And I think it somewhat leads to the question, you know, what if a really, really deep and demanding implementation such as Taproot were to come up, right? And a lot of people have their Twitter handle, you know, Taproot 2020 and so forth. I mean, I've heard Taproot is a pretty deep, has some pretty deep demands, right? How many people would want to risk the current Bitcoin infrastructure to implement an anonymous, anonymous chain? I would certainly want that anonymous chain, but what we have so far is also pretty good, right? So. It's a tough one there.
Yeah. And go ahead. One optimistic thing, at least for me, it's Bitcoin is in a sense attempting to be money, right? And money in an Austrian definition is the most liquid good in the world. If Bitcoin is going to be global money, it's going to be the most liquid good in the world. So that is kind of difficult, and that's when the scaling solutions have to work. But even if this is a if scenario, even if Bitcoin fails at that, which is not to say that it will, but if that means that Bitcoin can still have an incredible value. And this is a point that I like to make. Bitcoin competes with things that are not money. Also, it competes with long-term debt instruments. It competes with gold. I know people say all the time that Bitcoin is digital gold, and that some might be tired of this expression, but it doesn't make it any less true. It is true. So this, for me, is a cause for optimism that Bitcoin can, I mean, have an incredible effect on the world, no matter what it will achieve in these two directions.
Connor, you wanted to say something? You want to add something?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, there's a lot of really smart people working on Bitcoin, way smarter than myself. And, you know, if anything crazy did break because of whatever reason, I'm confident it would get patched very quickly. Worst case scenario, there's a hard fork. I don't ever see any sort of government being able to stop it or censor it, or any amount of use and abuse being able to really damage it all that much. I think it's here to stay.
I think if the need arises, I always have to think about what Jeff Foos always says is about exponential technologies. And, you know, the technologies we have right now, where it's been evolving in the last years or decades, it's like so exponential. It's deflationary by nature. So, it's really, we are super, super exciting times. I think if the need is there, as you said, there's like super creative you know, super intelligent, ingenious people out there who are going to develop, you know, the tools, and finally have, you know, the convenience and the, you know, the user friendliness and everything else that is really required right now, you know, for every, you know, age group, demographics we can think of. And I think it's going to happen much faster than we can even imagine, you know, as we say, gradual and suddenly. I think the suddenly will really come unexpectedly fast. That's what I see. So to wrap this up, do you guys have
to
any...
To add to that, I think...
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say to add to that, I think any downside risks to Bitcoin are a better option than the downside risks we face with centralized currencies.
So guys, I want to wrap this up. Do you guys have any final thoughts or do you want to like give off any final thoughts or I don't know, ideas for the future or do you see any structural changes coming up?
Go ahead.
Sorry, I'll just say, you know, if any of your viewers are not taking self-custody right now and they are interested and they're starting to see the benefits in that, check out Bitcoin Q&A. He's got a ton of great content and a lot of guides to help people get started down that direction.
So many others too. Yeah, Emil.
Yeah. So what I can emphasize then before we quit this, I would say keep an eye on what's happening out in the economy, out in the world. Because right now we have this steady siphoning through inflation. So the central banks sit in the middle like a parasite. And they, as I think it was either Economist or Mick that said, that they're sucking time from you. And it's correct. They are like a parasite. It sucks. That sucks time from you. And... where was I going with this? So keep an eye out on what's going on, because what is really scary is when it stops being this small siphoning, when there are real troubles in the world and they are done with the taxation, when the national debt has increased too much, so they can't really do more there. Some countries can actually, they can take more debt easily, so they don't have to tinker with the money as much. But some countries are already in so much debt, they will look at the printing presses then. So that's important for Bitcoiners to understand as well, that just because this past, let's say, 50 years have been pretty peaceful and there's no tyrannical edicts coming from the government, etc., when things go bad, they usually go to the money and make things worse. And when things get worse, the laws that come then, if we are inferring from history, are really tyrannical. So yeah, so let's... Self-custody is a very good advice.
Absolutely. And to echo that point and go back to the example I provided with Germany is very much that, actually, right? That the printing press has often come in parallel with the emergence of extreme political views. When people start going hungry, they will start blaming really anybody who can blame. And the German example is ferocious in terms of what happened, you know, in terms of the racial hatred that arose because of people's desperation. The example of the book are quite well done, because the Jewish examples were such that there were a lot of, there were a lot of Jewish immigrants who never trusted the German mark, right? It comes down to trust. A lot of the Germans trusted their governments, right? But the immigrants who were also used to many different monetary systems and had an understanding of gold and where to store their value, put their wealth somewhere else, and that's what saved them, and that's what also got them burnt after, and that's what that's why people went after them. And so don't trust, I think, don't trust governments, and look into money, trust yourself, trust numbers with your money, self-custody, absolutely. And be careful, because the next 10 years are going to be pretty turbulent if it is true that what we've been talking about, the directions between money, politics, lead to extreme positions.
That was awesome. I really enjoyed this talk. Always learn a lot. Maybe we can continue these talks next time. Either with the four of us, or maybe even together with Stephanie von Jahn. I really enjoyed this. Do you have any where can people find you? Let's start off with Alchemist.
I'm pretty active on Twitter. My handle is Econo Alchemist. I also have a blog at econoalchemist.com.
All right.
So you can find me on MetaMic14. I have a website, but mostly blogs on Medium and so forth.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter as well. I write about monetary history and Bitcoin mostly. It's at Besant Denier, or just search for Emil Sandstedt. I also have a webpage, bdratings.org, which I will update in a while now as I release the second book.
All right, cool. Well, hopefully we can continue this talk. Really enjoyed this. Thank you so much, guys, for your time and for sharing your knowledge, and have a good time. All right. Take care.
That's great.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Cheers. How did you enjoy this? I really had a blast. I really enjoyed this talk. It's always, fascinating to talk to Emil. And now for the first time, I had Mick and Econo Alchemist on my show. It was really down the rabbit hole. It's always important to reiterate those questions and question everything around us and really, have a interconnected comprehension, the root causes, and eventually, don't trust the government, don't trust the central bank, just trust yourself, because, these are criminal entities, and beyond any imagination, beyond any description. So I hope you enjoyed this. Let me know if you have any questions, and please make sure that you follow Mick, Econo Alchemist, and Emil Sandstedt on Twitter. I'm going to put their links on the show notes. And if you want to support me, please write a 5-star, positive review if you really love this show on iTunes or any podcast platform. My email address is hello@thetotalconnect.com. If you want to donate or, support me or us in our film project, Humanity Rooted in Bitcoin. We're also, working on a Bitcoin commercial, a teaser trailer, and a full documentary production. So I really had a blast. Hope you had that too. My name is Kevan Davani, and I'll see you soon again. Thank you so much again. Bye.